We are delighted to welcome Salem High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. The program's cleverly entitled Court with Class. And students are invited to come and listen to an oral argument. They are given materials about the case. They will hear with all of us. And at the end of the second oral argument, they will meet with a student, with a justice who is assigned to meet with the students that day. And the discussion will be the procedures of the court in accepting cases, deciding cases, and then issuing opinions. Everyone is invited to join the students. There will not be a discussion of the substantive issues about the cases. Does everyone have, who wants to have a copy of the summary of the case we are about to hear? If you wish a copy of the summary, raise your hand, please, and the marshal will give you a copy. Right. Let me, now that we have met the students, let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. You will meet with Justice Prosser after the second case. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left is Justice Patience Robensack. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. That's the lineup for this case. And I will now call our first case this morning, 2012 AP 2557 CR State versus William F. Bocconi. Arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle. Mr. Castle, this is your second appearance this month.
It is. I'm trying not to wear out my welcome. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle, appearing on behalf of the state. This is an ineffective assistance of counsel case. Defendant William Bocconi argued in the Court of Appeals that his lawyer was ineffective at his sentencing hearing for two reasons. First, for not objecting to some remarks made by the prosecutor that Mr. Bocconi claims undercut the agreed-upon sentencing recommendation. Second, he argued, relying on the Court of Appeals decision in Sprang, that counsel performed efficiently by not consulting with him before foregoing an objection to the prosecutor's sentencing remarks. The Court of Appeals agreed with both of those arguments and remanded for a new sentencing hearing. From the state's perspective, the important issue in this case is not whether the prosecutor's sentencing remarks undercut or undermined the agreed-upon recommendation. Rather, the important issue is how that issue is analyzed in the context of an ineffective assistance claim when, as is here, defense counsel did not object to the remarks.
Is that an indirect way of saying you're more interested in overruling the Sprang case?
Excuse me?
Is that an indirect way of saying you're more interested in overruling the Sprang case?
I am interested in overruling the Sprang case because that is one of the two ways in which deficient performance was found.
Okay.
But the more I thought about this case in preparing for argument, I thought it's equally important to look at the claimed overreaching by the prosecution in the context of an ineffective assistance claim. Because in some cases, the determination of whether counsel performed efficiently by not objecting is going to be pretty clear-cut. This Court's decision in 1997 in Smith, I think, provides an example of that. There, the plea agreement called for the prosecutor to make no sentencing recommendation. But at the sentencing hearing, the prosecutor recommended a sentence of prison of almost 5 years.
I want to ask this of both counsel, but I won't ask it again. You can comment as you see fit. But how do you think the victim crime rights legislation factors into this, if at all?
Well, I think it does, particularly with the claim regarding the prosecutor's conveyance of the victim's wishes.
And my recollection was, before sentencing someone or, you know, at various stages of as a judge, you'd say, have you complied with victim rights? Does the victim agree with your recommendation? What are the victim's thoughts? And that would be conveyed, whether there was an agreement or not. And I'm just wondering how that factors in as a practical matter in the context of strength. Part of what I'm concerned about is putting defense counsel in a position where they are always called upon to second guess what they should be doing to protect their client and themselves in light of that, which now exists that didn't exist maybe when Sprang was initially.
I want to make sure I understand your question in terms of the compliance with the victim's rights statute. Are you referring to it at the time of the plea itself? Because it comes into place, I think, at 2 points, whether
at each stage, I think it comes into play, but, you know, the state has a duty to convey what the victim's thoughts are, I think, or at least provide the opportunity for the victim to convey
That's right.
their thoughts. And so how does that factor into this analysis? Because you don't want to create an unworkable, you know, at the trial court level, you don't want to create an unworkable environment for counsel, for the court, for the state, if they still need to comply with this, right?
I agree you don't, and I think that's one of the problems with the Court of Appeals analysis and Mr. Bocchini's argument that in conveying the victim's wishes, that somehow breached plea agreement. This goes back to kind of a broader issue that is the theme in these cases, where the argument is not that, as in Smith or as we can go back to Santabello, where there was an agreement not to recommend a sentence and the prosecutor recommends a sentence. But in these much more difficult cases of figuring out is that fine line crossed, I think it becomes much harder to argue when when the prosecutor is conveying the wishes of the victim, which the prosecutor has a right, if not a duty, to do.
Sir, you just said in one of these cases, referring to this case, where it's a difficult case to determine whether the prosecutor crossed the line. Do you think this is a difficult case to determine? And I know you started your remarks by saying that you're not interested in whether the prosecutor, or you're less interested in whether the prosecutor breached the plea agreement, but don't we have to determine that before we even get to Sprang?
Yes.
There are two questions here, yes.
Yes and no. And here's why I'm saying yes and no.
Okay.
If the court says, no, there was no breach.
Right.
Then that's the end of it. Counsel is not ineffective for failing to make a meritless objection.
So is this a difficult case to determine whether there was a breach?
I think Mr. Bocchini makes a reasonable argument.
How so? Well, okay. If you want to argue,
I don't
go ahead.
Let me put it this way. I think a reasonable argument, I'm not ready to dismiss Mr. Bocchini's objections as totally frivolous.
This is close to the line.
What?
This is close to the line.
I'm saying this is close to the line.
Well, then, what comes close to the line?
Well,
there seem to be three statements here that the defense complains of. But tell me, in your opinion, what comes close to the line?
I think the closest to the line is where the prosecutor, I hate to be in the position of arguing against myself, but...
Well, you started it.
I did. Where the prosecutor says, after agreeing to recommend 4 years imprisonment, makes the remark about they have a right, as Mrs. Bocchini says in her letter, to live fearlessly while her son is growing up in school. He's 11 years old. So I think one could interpret that as saying he should be imprisoned for at least another 7 years. I don't think that's an unreasonable argument. I don't think it's the correct argument. I'll give you an example. I'm sorry, Justice Bradley.
I don't want to interrupt you, so if you're still answering, that's...
Well, I think this court's case in Williams gives, it's a 2002 decision, gives a perfect example of why those cases that are on one side or the other of the line can be so difficult. Now, Williams was not an ineffective assistance of counsel case. Williams, there was an objection, so it was a preserved argument. But in Williams, it was the same basic argument that the prosecutor's argument at sentencing undercut the agreed-upon recommendation. In the Court of Appeals, the two judges of the Court of Appeals agreed that it violated, that it breached the agreement. One judge said that it did not. When Williams reached this court, it was a 4-3 decision. The majority acknowledged this is a close question. Three justices in dissent said there was no breach. I would argue that if Williams had been an ineffective assistance counsel, even though the majority concluded that it was a breach, it would not have been deficient performance for counsel not to object. The fact that we have reasonable attorneys, reasonable judges, disagreeing about whether remarks cross that fine line demonstrates that it is not deficient performance to fail to object. And in this case, we have an experienced trial judge who, looking at these remarks, now, I will acknowledge, as Ms. Hagopian will no doubt point out, we're not looking for the effect on the trial judge. That's not part of the analysis. But in determining whether a reasonable attorney could have decided, as counsel testified, I didn't think there was anything objectionable. The fact that the same judge who presided at the sentencing, who, as she said at the post-conviction hearing, reviewed the transcript many times and said, you know, post-conviction counsel, I can see your argument, but I disagree. I think that tells us that a reasonable attorney could have decided that these remarks did not cross the line, even if it were a preserved objection, a reviewing court said, yes, they did. So that's why I'm putting the emphasis on ineffective assistance as guiding the outcome here. Now, that leads me to the second way in which the Court of Appeals, at the suggestion of appellate counsel for the defense, found that there was deficient performance.
Since you're no longer answering the question as I see it, I'm going to ask mine. Okay. That is, it seems to me that you're in a bit of a difficult place because what the state is really interested in is overruling State versus Sprang. But you don't get to that unless there was error. You're in a difficult place because you are arguing on the first issue there was no error. And if you prevail on that, the only thing you will have succeeded in accomplishing is resolving this individual case. And you're not really here for error correcting on this individual case. You've got to get over it. I don't mean it quite like that. You've got to get over the first issue. You're arguing there's no error, but you really want us to either find error or assume error, it seems to me. Otherwise, we don't get to the stated or the goal of the state to overrule State versus Sprang.
I mean, analytically, the court could go down that road, certainly. But I think, you know, the Sprang issue is presented. It's an issue of continuing importance because these cases do come up. You know, they came up not only in Sprang, but in the Lukunin case, if recollection serves, where the court of appeals sent it back to the trial court for, I believe, for a Mockner hearing, and pointed out even if there was a strategic reason, counsel may still have been ineffective for failure to consult. So I don't think a decision in the state's favor on this issue we have been discussing obviates the need to talk about Sprang, because Sprang establishes a whole separate duty for counsel. It says we don't care whether counsel performed deficiently or not by failing to object. In Sprang, it was counsel had a strategic reason, that is, counsel thought we're better off in front of this judge. In this case, counsel thought, I don't see a basis for objecting. Now,
I'm sorry, but in Sprang, is there an agreement that there was a breach of the plea agreement, that the state breached the plea agreement in Sprang? Isn't that the basis for Sprang?
I think there was an agreement, but there was the argument that there was no deficient performance.
But there was an agreement that the state did not do what it agreed to do.
I believe that's correct, yeah.
And defense counsel said, I knew it, but, you know, I just thought it better to let it pass than to make a fuss about it, because if we made a fuss, we might lose this judge, and the result might be we'd get another judge, and that would not be good for my client in defense counsel's position. Thus, in Sprang, defense counsel stayed quiet, but defense counsel may have made a good strategic decision, but what defense counsel failed to do was say to take the defendant aside and said, look, this is not what we agreed upon, but I urge you not to object, because, and then it was defendant, not defense counsel's decision to take or not take the plea agreement or to make an objection, because that's the basis in which he made a plea, right?
Right.
And then in this case, to get to Sprang, don't you have to agree that the state screwed up, to use a legal term?
I don't think, as I said, the court could decide this case in the state's favor without reaching Sprang.
Right.
No question.
And you'd like that, I assume.
Well, what?
You want that, I assume. You would like us to hold for you under any theory.
Right. But I think the bigger picture issue is not this particular case, except to the extent that I'm hoping to make the point that under the analysis we've been talking about so far, the mere fact that the court determines that there was a breach is not dispositive. The question is whether any reasonable attorney would have recognized that and objected.
Mr. Castle, what is the terrible thing that bothers you so much about Sprang?
Well, Sprang, taken on its face, I think, doesn't hold up logically. Sprang analogized the failure to object to a breach of a plea agreement to the modification of an agreement. Sprang said, this is just like State versus Woods. In Woods, there was a plea agreement in which the parties agreed that the state would make a particular sentencing recommendation. Afterwards, defense counsel and the prosecutor were talking. The prosecutor said, I think I'm going to have a hard time selling that recommendation to the judge. If we bump it up a year, I think I can sell that to the judge. Defense counsel says, okay, but doesn't consult with the client. And the basis for the Woods holding was there was no knowing and voluntary entry of a plea when the plea was modified. And it was modified by the express agreement of the prosecutor and the defendant's agent. Where Sprang goes off the rails, I think, is saying that the failure to object to an argument in breach of an agreement is the same thing as Woods. It results in a modification of an agreement. And under...
What about the duty to confer with the client before foregoing the objection?
Well, Sprang, rationalizes that on because there is a new agreement, that's an agreement to which the defendant must agree.
And I'm not so sure that the breach in Sprang was quite as clear-cut as sort of our discussion so far has. My notes indicate that Sprang pled guilty to one count of first-degree sexual assault of a child with the promise that the state would recommend probation. The PSI recommended supervision, but requested the maximum amount of jail time possible. The prosecutor then made statements regarding the impact of Sprang's offense on the victim and the victim's family, as well as the lack of responsibility Sprang had for his actions. Sprang appealed his denial of post-conviction relief, but asserted that he received ineffective assistance of counsel instead. The court reasoned that there was a material and substantial breach of the plea agreement because the prosecutor distanced himself from the initial plea agreement by emphasizing the PSI's disparity with the state's recommendation. Doesn't sound quite so clear-cut. So perhaps one of the things you'd like to address is where do we draw the line for implicit breaches, substantial and material, albeit implicit, breaches of the plea agreement?
Well, I think it is very hard to draw lines outside of particular cases. We can state the general rule that when there is a material and substantial breach, when the prosecutor's comments convey a backing off or distancing from the agreed-upon agreement.
The most obvious incident of that would be the prosecutor promises to recommend probation and jail time, but stands up in front of the judge and says, geez, I thought about this some more, and I really think 10 years initial confinement and 15 of extended supervision is appropriate. I mean, that's most clear-cut. But how do we get into these shades of, look, judge, the victim wants this for these reasons, I'm recommending this.
And I think it's not clear-cut. That's why you have cases like Williams, in which there's a division of the court. Four members of the court says, yes, that crossed the line. Three says, no, it didn't. And, you know, all I can't offer the court a clear-cut rule, because I think in any case it's going to have to be, you know, a case-by-case evaluation of exactly what the prosecutor said in the context of the entire sentencing hearing.
And it's
but,
yes.
Sprang is an anomaly in two senses. One, Mr. Bocchini hasn't cited, and the state's research hasn't revealed any other jurisdiction in this country that imposes this duty to consult. Yet the general principles that the prosecutor has to abide by the plea agreement and that defense counsel would be ineffective for not objecting, I think those would have to be near universal principles. The other reason I think Sprang is an anomaly is I am unable to come up with another example of where defense counsel, who was entrusted with defending, ensuring the protection of the defendant's right, must consult with the defendant about foregoing an objection. If the case goes to trial, the defendant, you know, in the plea agreement situation, the defendant has a due process right to have the agreement enforced. If the defendant goes to trial, the defendant also has a lot of constitutional rights. The defendant has a right to confrontation. But we don't say that if the prosecutor puts on evidence that arguably violates the confrontation rights of the defendant, the prosecutor must say to the defendant, there's a possible objection here. I don't think I'm going to object.
Defense counsel has to say that.
I'm sorry. Defense counsel doesn't have to say, I think there's a possible violation of your confrontation right here. I'm not going to object because I don't want to call attention to this. That's a perfectly good strategic reason. If during trial there is testimony or a prosecutor's argument in summation that arguably improperly comments on the defendant's right to silence, certainly that is as sacred a right as any other. We don't say that – I see my light is on. May I finish my sentence?
Finish your sentence.
We don't say that defense counsel must turn to the client and say, you know, I could object to that comment by the prosecutor in the argument to the jury. I'm not going to. I don't want to call attention to it.
Well, but counsel, then what you're pointing out is that the general rule is that trial decisions, evidentiary decisions generally, strategy for the trial are for the lawyer, not for the defendant, because it's the lawyer who is better equipped to do that. When we move into a plea agreement, we're back into whether a plea is well taken.
Excuse me, whether
a plea get into a plea agreement, and when we get into violation of a plea agreement, we're back into the basic issue as whether the plea was well taken. And the issue is also both criminal law and contract law, right? There's an overlap here.
Right.
Which you don't have at trial.
Correct.
And the contract rule is if there's a breach of contract by one party, the other party gets the contract, gets what he's due under the contract. Most of the time it's money, but this is a criminal case, and what he's due is adherence to the plea agreement, right?
Right. And I'm sorry, I didn't
And that's isn't that the issue here in this case?
But the issue is whether when there is an arguable breach and it requires professional judgment to decide whether there's been a breach or not, does...
Which this court decides.
Yes, whether or not there's been a breach, but whether or not...
And whether it's ineffective counsel.
Yes.
We decide. If we say, hey, there was a breach and there was ineffective assistance of counsel, then what does the defendant get?
Well, as a general rule, if the defendant asks for resentencing, the defendant gets resentencing under...
And that's what the
that's
what happened here.
Yes. There may be cases in which the defendant asks for withdrawal of the plea, in which case it's within the trial court's discretion.
And this is all even more complicated by the fact that both counsel have a duty to give full disclosure to the court.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Suzanne L. Hagopian, Assistant State Public Defender, representing the defendant, William F. How is it as you pronounce his name? Bokanyi? Pardon me?
Bokanyi.
Bokanyi. Thank you.
May it please the court. The legal principles governing a claim that the state has breached the plea agreement are well established, relatively easy to apply, and constitutionally sound. The court should decline the state's request to tinker with those standards. And here's why. Under what the state is proposing, the defendant would have no remedy, be entitled to no relief, even though the court concludes there was a material and substantial breach of the plea agreement, defense counsel had no strategic reason for failing to object, the defendant entered into the plea agreement with the expectation that the promises made by the state to induce his plea would be fulfilled. And in fact, the defendant has a right guaranteed by due process that those promises will be fulfilled. What the state is asking this court to do is contrary to fundamental fairness, the fairness that is mandated by due process but also necessary to make plea bargaining work.
So if this went back, you're requesting resentencing, right?
Correct.
Okay. So then at the resentencing, presumably a new judge gets it, and the state then would say, I'm recommending probation, here's the agreement we reached, and you'd probably have the same PSI, maybe a new one, but maybe not. And that would be satisfactory to you.
Well, the state would, the agreement called for the state to recommend no more than 4 years confinement. The expectation is that the state would adhere to that promise.
All right. And so long as they do that, the judge is going to probably know what happened in this case, right? But you're just assuming that. How does it factor in that the judge isn't bound by what the state recommends? I mean, how do we know that's deficient? I get that the state needs to stick to what they recommended, and I remember being frustrated from time to time because I'd say, look, it sounds to me like you're not recommending or sticking to the recommendation you made, and sort of puts the judge in a box then when the state does something like that or departs or comes close to the line. And I'd try to call him on it and see if someone wanted to withdraw their plea, if that would happen. Now I'm trying to figure out how we know this is deficient. How do we know a judge would come to a different result?
We don't.
Okay.
You know, a resentencing is not necessarily a windfall for the defendant. The judge at that resentencing, being a different judge, has a free hand.
So what's the second prong of ineffective assistance of counsel?
Second prong.
Efficient.
Right. Well, in State v. Smith, this court held that in this context of a breach of a plea agreement, that prejudice is presumed.
Okay.
So the test is somewhat modified. But Justice Ziegler, in some of the comments you made in terms of the judge being in a sort of difficult position, I think that that could very well be the case where the judge is recognizing a potential breach. But that's, I think, why it's important that the court hold the parties to the standards, hold the state to the standards that have been articulated now for 27 years.
Why isn't the better remedy here to just let this person withdraw their plea entirely?
Well, that is a possible remedy, but generally that is not one favored by the state. And so it is the court that decides what the appropriate remedy is, but the preferred remedy, as the courts have indicated, is a resentencing. I mean, really, that puts the parties back in the position they were before the breach. Mr. Bokenye's complaint has to do with the failure to comply with the part of the agreement, which was the state would not recommend more than 4 years confinement. So a new sentencing hearing where the state holds to that agreement puts everybody back in the position they were. I don't think that a plea withdrawal would be necessary in this case. But I did want to address, Justice Ziegler, also your question about victims' rights legislation. I don't think it's that hard to make all these duties work together. Clearly, the victim has a right to have her opinion, her recommendation, essentially, heard at sentencing. But what is significant is that the prosecutor cannot use the victim's recommendation or request as a way to undermine what the state has bargained to recommend. So looking specifically at what occurred here, the court may recall that the sentencing began with the prosecutor saying, I have a letter from the victim. She's here, but she doesn't want to read it. The court says, okay, well, you can read it. Now, in hindsight, at post-conviction, the court said, you know, it probably would have been better to have someone else read that letter, like a victim witness coordinator. I think that's true. However, that is not the basis for our claim that there was a breach. The breach occurred later in the prosecutor's sentencing argument, where the prosecutor not only referenced the letter, but endorsed it, adopted the victim's request as his own. He repeats from the letter that they have a right, as she says in her letter, to live fearlessly while their son is growing up and in school. She has a right to live not in fear that Mr. Bokenye, when he gets out, is going to come looking for her and to finish what he's attempted at least one other time. Now, a few paragraphs earlier, the prosecutor had reminded the court that the son was only 11 years old at the time of sentencing. What the victim was looking for and what the prosecutor adopted as his own request here was that Mr. Bokenye be confined until that child is grown and out of school. We can do the math. 4 years is inadequate to accomplish that goal. A sentence of at least 7 years, probably more, the prosecutor would know, because there was substantial sentence credit due this man. But a sentence of at least 7 years was necessary to accomplish that request. Now, there is nothing wrong with the victim putting that request before the judge at sentencing. The problem is that the prosecutor, who has induced the plea by making a promise that I won't recommend more than 4 years, cannot then, at sentencing, stand up and make that part of his recommendation. So I agree with the Court of Appeals.
What about
What
about the discussion of the dialogue at the jail? Was that inappropriate?
Yes. That referred to as the third breach, that the problem with that was not that the prosecutor brought that incident to the court's attention. The problem was the way he did it, his editorializing about it, his personalizing of the information. He began with this statement. What is, again, perhaps the most frightening for me is to read an incident report. Then he goes on to read the incident report, which contains threats made by Mr. Bokenya of his intention to shoot up some cops when he's released. Then the prosecutor ends it with this statement: there is an absolute necessity to protect the public from William Bokenya. The next sentence: I'm recommending a sentence of 8 years, 4 years confinement, 4 years extended supervision. Okay? The problem here came in with that editorializing. Can't keep information away from the sentencing judge. You can provide it. But when you start making those comments like, this is really, really bad, and this man really needs to be confined to protect the public, now we're starting to get into the area of a breach. And I would encourage the court to read this entire sentencing argument, as I'm sure it will. And that recommendation, the first time he mentions the actual recommendations of 4 years confinement, comes at that very point, and it is jarring. You read that and think, huh? So if the prosecutor was going to editorialize about that incident, knowing that he was bound to recommend 4 years, I would suggest he either drops the editorialization or he has to give a little bit more about why 4 years is still appropriate.
Counsel, you began your remarks, your argument, by saying something along the lines of, well, the law regarding substantial material breaches of plea agreements is longstanding and clear. I think that was the gist of it, right? And by that, I assume you were referring to State v. Williams.
And all the cases that came before and after.
Which are included in State v. Williams.
Mm-hmm. Well, Williams is a seminal decision, no question about it. But there are many cases discussing this sort of a breach.
And Williams is an example of those clear-cut rules.
Yes.
So I look at Williams, and I see what the majority based its opinion on. I see in paragraph 47 the phrase, the prosecutor implied. I look at paragraph 50, the state covertly implied. And I go down to paragraph 51, the prosecutor's covert message to the circuit court. So we are to, it's clear, in your opinion, when covert messages and implications are being made by the prosecutor to the circuit court judge. And first of all, I'm interested in that question. And the second is, as Mr. Castle noted, the presiding trial court judge in this matter has been on the bench over 10 years, probably closing in on 12 or 16, I don't remember exactly. What's left for the trial court's discretion and judgment to say, gee, this prosecutor's backing off this recommendation? I understand it's something we reviewed de novo. But it seems to me almost bypassing the one who is in the best position to judge what is actually going on in the courtroom, and that's the trial court judge. So, two questions. You think those standards are clear, and how, if at all, do we account for the trial courts or take into consideration the trial court's ability to discern, based on all the factors occurring before her, what's going on?
Mm-hmm. I'll start with your second question first, if I may.
Sure.
That you're correct. This is a question of law. And in Williams, the court made clear that what the reviewing court is doing is determining whether there's a material and substantial breach based on what is in the transcript. If the question of fact part of this may come in terms of what actually was said, I can imagine a case where it could go back in a post-conviction motion where the judge describes how it was said, the tone, the inflection, that could all be matters of made part of the factual record that then a reviewing court would consider as well.
So in other words, it might be part of the consideration whether the implied message was covert or overt.
Now, as to the standard, the legal standards, I think, are very clear. They've been in existence since at least State versus Poole, that the prosecutor cannot render less than a neutral recitation of the promised recommendation. Now, the court has gone on to explain that that means that the prosecutor cannot insinuate that it is distancing itself from the recommendation. It cannot imply that had it known certain information earlier, it may not have entered into this agreement. The standard is quite clear. Applying it to a particular case, sometimes maybe that is going to be a little hard. But you know what? It's the kind of exercise of judgment, decision-making that we ask lawyers to do all the time. We all work in a universe of standards, and we have to apply the facts of our case to that standard.
Of course we do. And in order to have fairness, we must have consistency. And I guess I'm curious as to how you see such standards as implications, covert implications, and covert messages as being clear standards that can be consistently applied, not just to this case, but to all subsequent similar cases that come before reviewing courts.
Because you look at what the prosecutor has said in total,
yes,
and you're examining whether what the prosecutor has said has undermined the recommendation they promised to make. And it depends upon the particular facts. So I agree with the Court of Appeals that the breaches occurred here. They're not close. They're egregious. And in part, that's so because the breaches in at least two instances had to do with numbers, the amount of time. We've already talked about the one, 4 years, not enough. We need at least seven to keep this victim and the son safe. The first breach was the maximum penalties, which the prosecutor recites, and then comments that those don't do justice to the seriousness of what happened here. Well, if 26 years doesn't do justice, then the 8 years that he's bound to recommend don't do either. So I would submit, Williams, a close case, this is not, because the comments that are at issue here in at least two instances went directly to the amount of time and are inconsistent with what the prosecutor was bound to recommend. I would also like to say, in terms of holding defense counsel to the standard of recognizing a breach, I would ask this court to go back and look at its language in State versus Smith, where it was talking about Strickland, ineffective claims, deficient performance. And it said that the failure to object to a breach of the plea agreement is different than other kinds of omissions that we would review. And it's different because the failure to object flies in the face of the defendant's earlier strategic decision to enter into the plea agreement. So the reason that a reviewing court defers to trial counsel's decisions in the context of an ineffective claim is that we're assuming that counsel's decisions are based upon conversations with the client, informed choices made with the client earlier in the representation. But when the lawyer fails to object to a breach, that omission goes directly contrary to what the lawyer knew going into sentencing, which was my client entered into an agreement where the state was to recommend no more than 4 years. My job is to hold the state to that recommendation. That's the assumption.
Counsel, one of the state's arguments is that the Sprang decision puts too big a burden on defense counsel. I found that interesting that the state's worrying about your burden, but what do you think, is that right?
No.
Okay.
What counsel, all it does is to require that counsel, once they've identified the breach, they consult with their client about whether the client wants to object and stop the proceeding or choose to go ahead. It actually provides some protection for the lawyer because you have that conversation and you're dealing with the stuff at the front end and not at the back end in post-conviction.
I agree with you. It's easier to deal with it then and there. If this would have come out differently and counsel would have objected and the court would have sustained the objection, what's the remedy then?
Well, if there's an objection then there and it's well placed, so it's sustained, then the proceeding should stop and there should be a new sentencing hearing before a different judge. And that really goes all the way back to Santabello. The, you know, the state refers to Sprang as an anomaly. You know, it is so well grounded in the constitutional principles recognized in this state that it makes complete sense. The decision whether to enter into a plea agreement belongs to the defendant. It's one of the few decisions that counsel can't make for the client. The client has to make that decision. So we also have case law saying that counsel can't agree to a modification of the agreement without the client's consent. We have that in Paskey, and we have that in Woods. Paskey was one where there, the record showed that the client had been consulted, had agreed to a change in the agreement before sentencing, and so it was okay. And Sprang is consistent with that. And, you know, the state in its reply brief said, I can't find any circumstance where the lawyer has to consult and then looks at Roe versus Flores-Ortega, a U.S. Supreme Court decision having to do with the failure to file a notice of appeal. But you know what? That decision is absolutely consistent with Sprang because what it said in that case is there is a duty to consult if and I want to make sure I get the language correct here. If the defendant had reasonably demonstrated his intent to appeal, then you do have to talk about, do you want to appeal? You can't just proceed and not file a notice of appeal. Well, look at, in our circumstance where you have a client who's entered into a plea agreement, that client has demonstrated their intent. They want this agreement. They want it enforced. So if something comes up in the sentencing, and the lawyer believes it's a breach, that lawyer has an obligation to say to the client, this is a breach, in my view. We could stop this proceeding. You could be resentenced before a different judge, or we can forego that. The lawyer may even give advice. You know, I think we're in front of the best judge in this county. We should stay where we are and continue on. The lawyer can make that advice, but it is the client who ultimately will make the decision.
Ms. Agopian, let me, if I might interrupt for a minute. I'd like to go back to the line of questioning from Justice Gableman. And what I'm concerned about is this. There was a motion, obviously, in front of the circuit court later asking for resentencing. The judge said, no, there wasn't a breach. She refused to resentence. Is there some deference that we should give to that judge? The judge was the person there listening to both sides, finding that there was no breach. Should there be some deference to that decision?
No. The question of whether there is a material and substantial breach is a question of law reviewed de novo. The court, you know, can be informed by the lower court's decision and reasoning, but this court would look at that independently. And it would look at that based upon what is in the transcript. It's an easy review in terms of there's no dispute of fact involved in this. So it's a review of what was the plea agreement, and then what was said at sentencing.
Could I ask a question? Court of Appeals talks about the prosecutor crossed the line in three respects. As I understand your position, it isn't necessarily the subject of any of those three things that you object to. It's more the editorial comments based on those things. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Number one was the recitation of the maximum penalties. There's nothing wrong with that. One might have said it was unnecessary because the court had just done that at the beginning of sentencing and there wasn't any dispute. But no, that's okay. The problem then comes in, though, when the prosecutor says that those just don't do justice to the seriousness. Similarly, the victim's letter, her wish as to what the disposition should be, that gets before the court. The problem comes in when the prosecutor, not just reading the letter before his argument, but in his argument, endorses it, personalizes it. It becomes part of his recommendation, and it's inconsistent with what he was bound to recommend. And the third one, again, the jail incident report, that certainly isn't favorable to the defendant, but the defendant could do nothing to keep that away from the court. It could come in, the prosecutor could describe it, could reference it. The problem is how he did that. And even the circuit court commented post-conviction that, you know, it would have been better had he not editorialized.
Well, now let me ask. Do you think that defense counsel should have objected basically three different times?
I don't think he would have had to. I think it would be perfectly reasonable for counsel to wait until the prosecutor's argument is done and make an assessment at that point. I think he could have, particularly the first, the second, either one would have been appropriate to say, wait a minute, Judge, I need a moment to consult with my client. But I don't think he had to. And there may be strategic reasons to lodge an objection early. It may also be perfectly reasonable to wait, because keep in mind, the prosecutor did not begin a sentencing argument by saying, you know, we're recommending 4 years confinement. And I'm not aware of any law that says he has to start that way. It came at the very end, and I can imagine defense counsel waiting. Like, am I going to hear it at all? And I think it is appropriate, and it would be a timely objection to make it at the end and should be made after consultation with the client.
So what do you think? Go ahead.
So I understand that there did not need to be three discrete objections. Suppose only one of these three had really surfaced in the prosecutor's argument. You think it would have been deficient performance not to object if there had only been one?
I think each one standing alone constitutes a material and substantial breach, and that is, in fact, what the Court of Appeals decided as well. But I also know that the law says that in assessing whether there is a material and substantial breach, you should look at the entire argument. At least the reviewing court should. So I think that, consistent with the Court of Appeals, this court certainly could hold that each one constituted a breach. I think the court could also reasonably hold that in its totality, when you put the three together, they amounted to a material and substantial breach. And I would say that the court, you know, the holding we're looking for is an affirmance of the Court of Appeals. I think they got it just right, that we have a material and substantial breach of the plea agreement. We have deficient performance by counsel for failing to recognize that. And really, that's as far as the court needs to go, because prejudice is presumed. Spraying never comes into play. Never comes into play in this case, because counsel didn't recognize the breach. And it only comes into play if counsel recognizes the breach, is thinking, got maybe some reasons why we shouldn't object. That's the obligation to consult with the client. When it just kind of goes over the lawyer's head, there's nothing to consult about. Spraying doesn't come into play. Now, I feel very strongly that this case is the wrong case to consider spraying for that reason, but I will confess that I muddied the waters a bit in my Court of Appeals brief when I cited spraying. But if I were writing that brief over again, I wouldn't. And I would like this Court to look at paragraph 31 of the Court of Appeals decision, because it's absolutely clear that my citing to spraying did not mislead the Court of Appeals. Their determination of deficient performance had nothing to do with a failure to consult. It was the failure to recognize that the breaches in this case were objectionable. That's the basis of the Court of Appeals holding, and that's what I think this Court should hold as well. Unless there are any other questions?
I just read paragraph 33, and you're right.
I will just say one last thing, which is another case that the state cited in its reply brief, and so I didn't have a chance to respond to, was State versus Woods, a very recent Court of Appeals decision, finding that the prosecutor's argument was not a breach. I think you can make an interesting contrast between the comments made there, which the prosecutor said, you know, some of these things in the PSI are alarming, goes on to talk about those facts. Note a couple of things. One, those comments aren't going to the length of time needed. It's not a discussion of numbers like we had here. And second, the prosecutor ended his sentencing argument with an explanation as to why the sentence he's bound to recommend is appropriate. A direct head-on, this is why our recommendation is appropriate. That's missing from this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Castle.
Counsel, I wonder if hearing this discussion, the thought occurs that perhaps the state has set its sights on the wrong target. You have aimed squarely at spraying. The conversation and parts of the conversation that have occurred here today, perhaps I wonder if the state is asking us to review Williams, a 12-year-old decision of this court, and I quoted parts of it where the basis, the standard rests on implications, both covert and covert messages. Why aren't you asking us to revisit Williams?
I thought asking the court to revisit Sprang was enough to bite off in one argument.
And I think the conversation, and I think the conversation that's occurred here today shows why you have apparently an uphill battle on that. Right? I mean, especially your colloquy with the Chief Justice, where she outlaid the logic of your situation, and you agreed with her all the way along, and I see nothing incorrect in that discussion, so.
Well, and, you know, I accept the court may decide this is not the case to decide, Frank. Williams, the principle enunciated in Williams is not unique to Williams. The idea that there can be a breach by covert subtextual language. I think.
What do you mean? What do you think Williams means when it says covert message? What does covert mean in that context?
Well, I think it means that when the prosecutor, in effect, as Ms. Hogopian says here, well, the prosecutor was just giving lip service. The prosecutor says, yes, this is my recommendation. But a case in which the prosecutor says, boy, but had I known all I know now about the defendant.
That doesn't sound very covert to me. I mean, for instance, what highlights it, I think, in this particular instance, in the case we're here on today, is the letter from the mother. Now, I think when Justice Ziegler was asking you questions earlier about victims' rights legislation, you candidly, you know, obviously, you acknowledged what's obvious, which is that the prosecutor had the not only right but the obligation to present the victim's point of view. My recollection from 6 years on the trial court bench is the trial court has a lot of discretion as to how that information is going to be presented. And it's basically the victim's choice. In this case, it wouldn't surprise me that Judge Gail Weirich would have said, ma'am, do you want to address the court? Do you want the state to? Or however she wanted ordered. So, and the judge, the trial court judge, in fact, can be sued personally. When I was on the bench, it was $1,000. I don't know if it's gone up. If they don't inquire as to whether compliance with victims' rights. So by reading the letter from the victim, and as we all know, it's not uncommon for victims to vehemently disagree with the prosecutor's recommendation. So is that a covert message by definition to the judge?
No, but I don't understand that to be precisely Ms. Agopian's argument.
Right. It's the repetition of the part of the child in school. Now, all of you seem to have assigned a certain definite time period of 7 years implicit. I don't know that during spontaneous arguments or even arguments that are scheduled well in advance, that in my experience and observation, prosecutors sit down and do the math about when someone's going to graduate from high school, or even the fact that the education is going to stop at high school, or does in school mean, well, the kid is in school, the child is in school tomorrow?
Well, I was not agreeing with Ms. Agopian that was a breach. I was just saying that I thought was her best argument.
Sure, I understand.
And I think, you know, one of Judge Gail Weirich's comments at the post-conviction hearing gets, I think, at what you're saying. You know, it's very easy to sit, we got the transcript in front of us, and go back and parse it word for word.
Right.
And see, let's pick out some words that we can argue were a breach. And that leads me, if I may, to respond to Justice Crooks, a question, Justice Crooks, that you, I'm sorry, my time is up.
You may respond quickly, please.
Justice Crooks, you asked Ms. Hagopian, shouldn't there be any deference to the trial judge? And the answer is, in determining whether there was a breach or not, the answer is it's a de novo review. But in determining whether counsel was ineffective, whether any competent lawyer would have objected, I think the fact that this trial judge, looking at the remarks and saying, I've read them over several times, I don't see a breach, I think that definitely informs the court's decision, was counsel incompetent for not raising the breach?
Chief, if I may, but wouldn't any trial judge really be an objective standard? And, of course, objective is de novo. I mean, excuse me, any trial judge, but you indicated that the trial circuit court judge here said any attorney. And when you get to that kind of language, isn't that implicitly an objective standard?
It is an objective standard, and that's deficient performance is an objective standard. But I think in determining, I don't think we talk about what a competent lawyer would do, what by an objective standard, I still think that can be informed by what an experienced trial judge makes of the situation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. On behalf of the court, I want to thank both counsel. Assistant Attorney General Castle and Assistant State Public Defender Agopian for their briefs and their excellent arguments today on yet another breach of plea agreement case. So ends the hearing on 12-8-P-2557-CR, State versus Bocanyi. The court will take a few minutes in recess so these students may leave if they wish, and we have other students coming in.